Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Day 17 of the federal government shutdown, now the second longest in history, and there's no end in sight. On Friday, President Trump doubled down. He confirmed to CBS's Major Garrett that he told the House and Senate leaders he would keep the government closed for months, even years, over funding for his border wall.
Did you say that?
And I did.
Is that your,
I did.
Is that
border
your assessment
secure,
of where we are?
That. Absolutely, I said that.
But it's having tangible and even heartbreaking effects on hundreds of thousands of real people, like IRS employee Lori McCann.
I'm not going to say whether or not I understand about the wall. I understand that I'm not getting another paycheck. This is our reality, which is our bills have to be paid. We want to do our jobs, and we're hurting.
800,000 federal workers are affected by this shutdown, and millions more Americans could see interruptions in food stamp benefits. TSA workers are calling out sick, possibly in protest. Garbage and human waste is piling up in national parks. And tax filing season is just around the corner, which could keep your refund out of your mailbox for now. Well, this hour on Point, where the government shutdown is hitting Americans hardest. And you can join us. How has the shutdown affected you and your finances? Are you a federal worker who's been furloughed, or perhaps even one who is still at work but not getting paid? What do you want to see from President Trump or congressmen and women in Washington to end this stalemate? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, joining us first today is Lisa Desjardins. She's with us from Arlington, Virginia. She was at a contentious press conference at the White House on Friday. We have a link to her reporting at onpointradio.org. And Lisa is, of course, correspondent for the PBS NewsHour, where she covers Congress. Lisa, welcome back to the show.
Hello, Meghna. Great to be here.
It's good to have you. Let's just hear a little bit of what some lawmakers said over the weekend about the shutdown. First of all, I want folks to hear House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. She told CBS Sunday Morning just yesterday that even though she, as Speaker, has awesome power, quote, awesome power, there's only so much she can do to reopen the government.
If the President of the United States is against governance and doesn't care about whether people's needs are met, or that public employees are paid, or that we can have a legitimate discussion, then we have a problem and that we have to take it to the American people.
That's House Speaker Democrat Nancy Pelosi. South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham also yesterday told CBS's Face the Nation that he's spoken with the president over the weekend about the shutdown, and it's clear to Graham that there will not be a deal to end a shutdown without a wall.
We're having to negotiate with people who want to abolish ICE, not support ICE. We're having to negotiate with people who see the Border Patrol agents gassing children rather than defending our borders as professional law enforcement officers. And we're negotiating with people who will give us $1 for the wall, even though it's immoral, and accuse all of us who support a wall as part of border security is racist. As long as the radical left is in charge, we're never going to get anywhere. The president will compromise, but he will not capitulate.
That's South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham. Lisa, where are we today? It sounds like there is a deeper entrenchment than there even was last week.
That's right. And I think that's been growing since the middle of last week when Congress returned from the holiday break. We're seeing basically a testing between new powers, between the Democratic House and Speaker Pelosi and President Trump. This is a test for what they think the next 2 years will look like. And for now, they are digging in because each wants to flex muscle and set a tone that goes beyond this shutdown. But the problem is today and tomorrow, the affected agencies of government will need to start processing payroll if their employees are to get a paycheck on Friday. So if there is no progress, and it doesn't look like there will be, in this shutdown in the next couple of days, there will be a delay for 800,000 federal workers. And, of course, there are many contractors who already have been going without pay. And we don't know how long that delay in pay will be.
Well, so take a step back here with me, Lisa, because you've done some really good reporting, excellent reporting on the effects of the shutdown on government workers. But I want to get a big picture sense from you on something. I mean, Is this a stalemate of between two different sets of principles, you know, with the president on one side and Democrats on the other? Or, you know, if, or is there room for political maneuvering here? Because I just see, like, in general, in human nature, when you have an impasse over principle, that's tough to negotiate.
I think that both are in play. I think most of these shutdowns do begin with some layer of principle, and that's why you get to a shutdown. Something must be important enough for one side to think that it needs to go to a shutdown, and that it will, the side sort of instigating the shutdown needs to think its principles are important enough that its supporters will stick by them through a shutdown. So there are principles here, and of course, one of the toughest debate the nation faces right now over immigration and over border security. But I do think, as you're implying, the bigger factors are very messy and partisan politics that have gotten worse over the past few years. And it's not just partisan politics, but the gamesmanship in Washington has only increased. You know, we've had dozens of shutdowns in our nation's history. However, we have only had a handful, I think just four, that had significant timeframes where workers were sent home. And as you said, this is the second longest. But of those four, three were the last three shutdowns. So we see government shutdowns being used more often, and they are getting longer. We are seeing politicians become more callous to the effects of a shutdown because they are using it more and more as a partisan tool.
Well, and I know, as you've reported on the NewsHour, that Congress's own staffers are still getting paid, and the White House's staffers are still getting paid. Mm-hmm. So maybe they're also, because they're not directly feeling the effects of their own offices not being able to function, that might sort of make this a little more distant. But of course, this is not distant at all for those 800,000 federal employees who are suffering from this shutdown. So, Lisa, stand by for just a second, because I want to turn to Julie Burr here for a moment. She's joining us from Parkville, Missouri. She's an administrative assistant with the Department of Transportation in Kansas City. Now, she's a contract worker who's employed by a third party, not a direct federal employee, which means that even when this shutdown ends, Julie may not receive any back pay that she's missing out on now. So, Julie Burr, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
How have you been doing so far? I mean, have you been able to make ends meet thus far, Julie?
So far, yes. I was very fortunate. I started a GoFundMe, and I have met my goal. I made a goal of approximately 2 months of salary, and I met my goal, so I'm okay for now. But I tell you, when I first started, I was very worried. And for others in my predicament, I'm very worried.
Okay. So tell us what impact this has had on you.
Well, stress for one thing. You know, I just want to get back to work. I just want to get back to earning my paycheck. And I feel like every day when I turn on the news or the radio, you know, I hear that there's really no end in sight, and it just gets more stressful day by day to all of us.
Now, I see that you talked about you've done some individual fundraising to get by, but also do you have a seasonal job as well that's helping you make ends meet?
Correct. I took a seasonal job at Barnes & Noble bookstore just for some extra Christmas money. And they have been very kind to me. They've kept me on after the Christmas season was over. And I've even had other employees there give up shifts for me so that I could work a little bit extra. So they have been like a family to me. They've been very kind, not only the managers, but also fellow employees there.
Yeah. How long can that last, though?
Exactly. And it's only about 25% of my pay that I would be receiving at my contract job with the government. So it does not pay all of the bills.
Huh. Oh, so you said it's only a quarter of the pay. Is that right? Did I hear that right?
Correct. Yes, okay. Correct.
And what effect is this having on your family?
Well, I have a 14-year-old son still living at home. I have two other children that are grown and out of the house. But my son here at home with me is stressed about it also. He asks daily, when are you going back to work? Is anything changed? You know, things like that. So I can tell that it's weighing on his mind a bit also.
Well, I want to play something for you here that the president said yesterday when he said he says he understands the plight of federal workers. And here's what he said.
I can relate, and I'm sure that the people that are on the receiving end will make adjustment. They always do.
Julie Burr, how do you respond to the president saying he can relate to what you're going through now?
Well, I find it hard to believe that a billionaire could relate to someone who lives paycheck to paycheck, which most of us do these days. Very few people have a lot of money in savings to go through 1 or 2 months without a paycheck. So I find that difficult to believe that he can actually relate to that. You know, I don't know. I'm not going to disparage anyone, but I just feel like if they could just all come to a compromise, we could all get back to work, and that's what we want most of all.
Well, I mean, if you could send a message to the president or even members of Congress, what would you tell them?
I would tell them, let us get back to work. You know, let us bring the government back up, do your compromising, whatever you need to do. But we just want to work. We just want to. The most important thing to us right now is taking care of our families. And if we can't do that, nothing else matters.
Well, but I mean, the president says he believes that having a wall on the southern border does matter enough to shut the government down potentially for months or even years.
Well, I believe in border security. Nobody wants extra crime in their country. Nobody wants drugs brought into their country. No one wants that. So, you know, to put us against each other, I think is wrong. But I believe in border security, yes, but I'm not sure a physical wall is going to do the trick.
Well, Julie Burr, she's an administrative assistant with the Department of Transportation in Kansas City. Joining us today from Parkville, Missouri, she's one of the 800,000 federal workers who is currently not receiving a paycheck. And as we mentioned earlier, Julie is a contract worker. So that means that even when the government is back in business, she may not receive any back pay. Julie, thank you so much for joining us, and best of luck to you.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
Well, we are talking this hour about the direct impact the government shutdown is having on the lives of individual people, not just government workers. We'll talk about Native American tribes when we come back and how the impact is even spreading further to Americans on food stamp assistance, Americans receiving home assistance as well. Lisa Desjardins joins us. She's a correspondent for the PBS NewsHour, and we want to hear from you. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken? Podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about how, as the government shutdown drags on, it's having an impact on the lives of more and more Americans, those 800,000 federal workers, for first of all, but then also millions more Americans. For example, the Department of Housing and Urban Development has sent letters to 1,500 landlords late last week as part of a last-minute effort to prevent the eviction of thousands of tenants. We've talked about the IRS and how they'll have difficulty servicing tax refunds. The National Park Service is trying to keep services at the national parks open amongst lots of human waste and garbage everywhere. 38 million Americans could lose access to food assistance next month because the Agriculture Department is also caught up in the shutdown. Well, Lisa Desjardins joins us. She's correspondent for the PBS NewsHour, where she covers Congress. And Lisa, I mean, as the shutdown, you know, goes on and on and on, how many more departments or how many more effects are we likely to see? How are the tentacles of the shutdown going to reach to?
Yeah, I think it's the same tentacles, but they will reach farther and farther because we will start to see economic spillover effects, especially from things like where you see large kind of cores like the Washington area or particular national parks where the federal agency involved is a big part of the economy. We're already seeing in Washington, I know, having spoken to workers and businesses here, there are some businesses that are near the Smithsonian which are really having trouble. They are not seeing the foot traffic from either tourists or workers that they're used to having. So I think once those economic effects, even outside of the federal workforce, start mounting, then we will also see pressure mount on lawmakers. But you know, we've already seen lawmakers try to ask for special exclusions for the areas that affect their state the most. Like Senator Steve Daines of Montana wrote a letter to the Department of Interior saying, listen, I believe that you should restock, for example, some facilities and bathrooms in our national parks. He made a case that he felt that that was an emergency need. It hasn't been in the past, but the Department of Interior is making some changes and trying to move some money around to keep some parks open. So we're seeing lawmakers already feel the pressure from their local economies.
Right. And I'm seeing here that I believe it was the Washington Post had a story where they were talking about how even smaller communities could get disproportionately hit by the shutdown. I mean, there are small towns. They pointed to Pollock, Louisiana, where the biggest employer there is a federal penitentiary. And then they quoted David Cox Sr., who's the president of the American Federation of Government Employees, saying that, quote, our members get an average take-home pay of $500 a week, and next week they aren't going to get that. The places that are getting slammed are ones like Pollock that you can't even find with a GPS.
Right. And right now we're also seeing home loans getting snagged because even if the home seller may not be a federal worker or involved in the shutdown, if their buyer is involved or if their loan is involved through any of a number of federal programs that back some home loans, then there's a problem there.
Right.
And so we're seeing this have many different effects in many different parts of our economy and world.
The Small Business Association, now I'm reading as well, could affect 30 million small businesses nationwide that need the SBA to process loans for them. So the list goes on, but let's get a couple of callers in here. Caitlin is calling from Detroit, Michigan. Caitlin, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I am going through treatment for cancer at the moment. I'm a social worker that consults, so I have absolutely no paid time off. We were in the process of refinancing our home so that there could be some finances that could come through for us. We were in the final stages, and unfortunately, due to the shutdown, the IRS cannot is closed, or at least the department where we need our documents, and they cannot turn over the final documents that we needed to finish our refi.
Wow. Caitlin, so what are you going to do?
I told her when they answered the phone, I'm fuming. I don't know what we're going to do. We're hanging in there. We are blessed with, you know, some families and friends that can support us, but we're kind of at the end of our rope. And I do have to say, I don't support the wall. But if the Republican reason for this is to protect American citizens, then they should do what we need to be protected, which is things like, you know, refinancing our homes and home loans so that we can beat cancer. I really think it's spreading to ways that they either didn't imagine or aren't in touch with. And to be honest, I don't know what we're going to do. We're going to hold out and wait and hope even that the loan processors understand this and don't sort of like yank our application back or make us start all over.
Right. Well, Caitlin, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Laura, who's calling from Des Moines, Iowa. Laura, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. So I have a small business here in Des Moines, and I don't think I have any federal employees that I'm, you know, that work with me, but it's really starting to make me nervous, just that trickle-down effect. And from what I understand, you know, being from Georgia, I know Newt Gingrich, I know the Freedom Caucus. You've got people running this country that do not like federal government. And when you heard our president say he would be honored and happy to shut our government down, you're hearing words from people behind him that just literally want to shut down the EPA. They want to shut down the Interior, or the Department of Interior, the USDA. We've got farmers here that not only are being hurt by the tariffs, but they're not getting the money promised to them to help them.
Right.
And if, you know, if it's just about a wall, then it just doesn't make sense because We already have a wall. We have fences. And when you've got people coming into this country that want to find a better life and want to work, especially for agricultural, you know, areas, it's just he's holding us hostage. This yeah. president is maniacal.
Well, Laura, thank you for your call. Lisa Desjardins, Dan, let me just turn back to you on that one. Just what does Laura make you think?
Right. You know, I think one of the issues here is that these are two sides that are not just fighting over the wall right now. They're fighting over whether the wall will be funded for the next 2 years at least. And in that way, they're also fighting over the next presidential election because this was a promise that President Trump made. So what happened, and Laura was right to raise the Freedom Caucus, because the president had signaled that he was ready to sign on to a deal that would keep all of these government agencies funded through February 8th. That is the deal that went through the Senate unanimously.
Right.
You know, they all thought this was going to happen. Vice President Pence told them he thought the president was going to sign it. And the Freedom Caucus took to the floor of the House the night before the president before it was moving to the House and said, Mr. President, this is your last chance. This is a betrayal if you sign on to this deal. We saw conservative kind of talk radio hosts and commentators on Fox News also push the president. And it was that push from the right saying, this is your last chance to get this money before Democrats take over the House. That is what changed everything. So this is now a calculation over the next 2 years of trying to get any wall funding. And it is hard to imagine that Democrats will give in because of that. They don't want to give in now and then have to give in again and again over the next 2 years. Similarly, the president feels the same way.
Well, you know, so it's pressure from the ideological right that the president is feeling or responding to. But I was really fascinated by a New York Times piece this weekend that said that there are a lot of folks who are advocates who are conservative on immigration, right? Who are now feeling concerned that the president has boxed himself in over this wall because opportunities to strengthen the border in other ways are sort of falling by the wayside. That they don't even want the wall. I mean, I'm not talking about the Rush Limbaughs of the world. I'm talking about, you know, sort of the Washington conservative think tanks who want to find other more effective ways to deal with migration over the southern border.
That's right. And that, to me, is the tragedy of this particular shutdown, is that we have a very serious series of issues that affect many millions of human beings right now, not government workers and immigrants and people who live on the border. And we're not actually talking about the very large body of knowledge in terms of what works on the border. And we know the border is not just one long, flat parking lot. It is a series of sometimes rivers, sometimes mountains, sometimes reserves, sometimes areas where cattle graze across lands. It is a complicated place. And we're not having a real discussion over, have other countries tried a steel slat fence? What does that do? And, you know, where has it worked? Where has it not? There's a very serious, there are very high policy stakes here. And there is a lot to talk about. This has been studied. And yet we're not talking about it that way because the president has said wall or no wall.
Yeah. Well, Lisa, hang on here for just a second, because let's turn back to our discussion of the direct impact this shutdown is having on people. And joining us now is Aaron Payment. He's joining us from Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan. He's the tribal chair of the Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians. Aaron Payment, welcome to On Point.
Ani, bonjour, good day. I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
So tell us, in these past 17 days, what effects have you seen on the Sault Ste. Marie regarding this shutdown? How has it had an impact on you?
So first, tribes are funded one of two ways, either direct service tribes or self-governance tribes. My tribe is a self-governance tribe. Direct service tribes are more immediately impacted because the federal government provides the services, and in many cases, those federal team members or employees are laid off or are furloughed. My tribe is a self-governance tribe, so we receive regular disbursements of the federal dollars that we prepaid through our treaty rights. And so what we've done is my tribal council allocated resources from our unspent tribal support dollars or reserves. But we only have about a 2 to 3 week window, and a critical deadline is January 15th, which our next drawdowns are scheduled to happen. At that point, we will have to consider layoffs and furloughs and having to restrict services to emergency services rather than the full complement of services that we provide.
So what kind of services are we talking about then?
One critical one is Indian Country is experiencing the opiate crisis as bad as anybody. And we will have to, our treatment resources will be interrupted. One thing, and very specifically, is prescriptions for Vivitrol, which people use to prevent them from feeling the full effects of addiction and to wean them off of opiates, will not be available. And so we have to figure out if we're going to borrow money or how we're going to be able to provide those prescriptions. Also, one of your earlier callers had mentioned about cancer, mm-hmm. and we provide medicines for cancer, and also diabetes and heart disease are life-threatening for our people, and those also could be interrupted. Another area is we provide commodity foods through the USDA, so this will affect farmers down the chain in the food supply. And so the federal government provides the food to us, and then we distribute them at our distribution centers. That also could be interrupted if the food supplies are interrupted.
Yeah. So is the tribe now having to think about, okay, if this happens, if we get to January 15th or beyond, I mean, how will you cope? Is there a plan?
Our administration is drafting up options to go over with our tribal council. We have a meeting actually real soon. And to walk through the possibilities, and we're trying to be very careful not to alarm our team members, because the last time a shutdown happened, it cost us about $1 million, mm-hmm. and we lost several medical staff, and we're in a rural community, so it's difficult to recruit and retain them. So we're trying to find options that we can walk through and explain with our council, but it really depends on how long this goes. Right now, it doesn't look hopeful that the president is going to capitulate and try to find a way to reopen the government. There's always tomorrow to have these political battles. Tribes are not Republican or Democrat. We're I for Indian. We're independent generally. And all we ask for is for the federal government to fulfill its treaty and trust responsibilities.
Well, you know, Aaron, a little earlier in the show, I asked Julie Burr, the other federal worker that we've spoken to, if she could send a message to the president or Congress, what would she say? So same question to you.
Well, I would say to the president, Mr. Trump, your rent is due. We prepaid. We can't foreclose on the land that we traded. We traded 500 million acres across the country. My tribe in specific traded 14 million acres. So given we can't foreclose, we are reliant on the federal government to do their job, to look past partisanship, to find a way to reopen the government. And tribes are generally conservative when it comes to border security, although it's kind of an ironic concept because we welcomed everybody to our territory. But we ask that Mr. Trump find a way to reach across the aisle to find a temporary solution and continue to negotiate to try to make our borders more secure.
Temporary solution. Well, Aaron Payment is tribal chair for the Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians, joining us today from Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan. Thank you so very much for joining us.
Jamie Gretchen, thank you.
Well, Lisa, hang on here for just a second because there are a lot of callers who want to join us. I want to get some more stories in. So let's go to Danny, who's calling from Pensacola, Florida. Danny, you're on the air.
Hello, and thank you for having me. I just want to mention that, I'm active duty in the Coast Guard. It's the only military branch that will not be paid if there's not action by the 11th of January, aka this Friday. I just want to mention that, among other things, its critical missions include maritime security as well as search and rescue. There are a lot of important missions. Unlike most federal employees, Coast Guard members, military members, they don't have a choice where they live, and support systems for them are limited. I just want to throw that out there.
Yeah.
And that's my point there.
Well, Danny, thank you so much for your call. Danny said he was in the Coast Guard, Lisa, and actually mm-hmm. we asked over social media for people to send us their stories about how they're coping with this shutdown, and we got a really interesting story from someone named Anthony Setterstrom. Anthony, I hope I said your name right. He's a retiree, and he's saying that if the shutdown lasts into February, retirees won't receive pay. He says retirees and their families from the Department of Homeland Security and six other agencies will be affected. He's a 26-year veteran of the Coast Guard, and although he received his retirement pay for the first of the year, February's pay is in question, and he has to tighten his belt and prepare for the worst. So even government and retirees here, I hadn't heard that before, but it makes perfect sense if, you know, if no money is going out at all.
That's right.
And so I guess that was just a story there. But I guess I come down to this. How long can this go on? I mean, how long can this spread before members of Congress and the president start hearing more of these stories directly and feeling a different kind of pressure to sort of bring this impasse to an end?
I think this week is a pivotal point for us to determine how long this could go, because if our lawmakers are able to continue with, you know, no traction, no sign of progress, and really no real negotiations through, you know, 800,000 people missing a paycheck, which happens this Friday, I think that will be a sign that it could last quite a long time. Now, if that paycheck doesn't go out and we're speaking a week from now and there are more of these stories, we have people who have trouble making the rent, people who are worried whose mortgage may be in trouble. We'll see next week if that pressure is enough to spark real negotiations or not. But if not, then this could be even longer.
Wow. Well, Lisa Desjardins is correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. She covers Congress. Lisa, hang in here for a second. We have to take a quick break. We're trying to get a sense this hour about the direct impact the government shutdown is having on the lives of millions of Americans, those 800,000 federal workers. Millions more through things, as we've been discussing, like the Small Business Association not being able to help small businesses process loans, the IRS not being able to process tax refunds, food stamps, people dependent on food stamps perhaps at risk as well. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the direct effects that the government shutdown is having on 800,000 federal employees, many of them contract workers who may never receive the back pay that they're missing out on now, even when the government reopens, and also on the millions more Americans who rely on the services that those federal agencies provide to them. Lisa Desjardins joins us. She's a correspondent for the PBS NewsHour, where she covers Congress. And Lisa, we've actually got a really interesting question that's come in on through Facebook to us. Amy Mallison Austin is asking, can the president really keep the government shut down for years? I can't even see Mitch McConnell standing for that. So I'm curious, Lisa, what do you think about that? Because first of all, Senator McConnell has said that he's not going to bring any continuing resolution to the floor of the Senate that the president won't support. But he's also been very quiet over the past several days. Where has he gone?
Well, that's a fascinating question. I think first to Amy's question, can he keep government shut down? He can keep government shut down as long as he has more than a third of the votes in each chamber. Because, you know, if it gets to a point where the president is digging in and he has lost, especially Republicans in the Senate, which, by the way, they're already very unhappy with the president when they speak to you privately, they can override the president. They can pass a funding bill with two-thirds votes in each chamber. So I think it politically it seems unlikely that it could go years, because I think the president would be overridden if he digs in that deeply. But I think speaking to Senator McConnell, you know, at that news conference, one of the first things all of us standing there noticed on Friday was we were looking in the Oval Office to see who was coming. We saw Kevin McCarthy, the new Republican leader in the House. We saw Steve Scalise, his deputy. We saw Mick Mulvaney, the acting chief of staff. And we did not see Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader of the Senate. I reached out to Senator McConnell's office. Now, There is no more on-message Republican than Mitch McConnell. Mm-hmm. He rarely talks to reporters. He is never off-message. He is very disciplined. And I, to my surprise, received a response from them that was very direct and addressed my question directly, saying, why wasn't Mr. McConnell there? They said he had not been told about the availability, the press availability. And if he had been asked by the president to attend, he would have. To me, to a Capitol Hill reporter, that was sort of earth-shaking that Mitch McConnell's office would come out publicly and make it clear the president had not invited him. So the president is surrounding him by himself with conservatives and not by pragmatists like Mitch McConnell at the moment.
I mean, but is McConnell a pragmatist on this? Because again, I keep hearing him say he's not going to put anything on the floor of the Senate to a vote that the president won't approve.
But that is also pragmatic, really, right now, because he's already made his senators vote for something that the president turned his back on. So he knows the president is unpredictable. And so he's waiting for the president to really stake out a position that is viable, which has not happened yet.
OK. But pragmatism, perhaps in the most cynical political
maybe.
Way.
Maybe. Has it gotten that bad? I guess it has. But yes. Yeah. But I do think when it comes to fiscal crises, Mitch McConnell is someone who has repeatedly tried to steer the ship through rocky shores and tried to avoid. He does not like these crises. He does not like a debt ceiling crisis or a shutdown. He is someone who wants to avoid it and wants it to end quickly. He knows there are repercussions, especially for his side in this shutdown.
Okay. Forgive me for tussling with you on this, Lisa.
I
don't quite get it here. I mean, if he wants this to end quickly, and you also said that perhaps there would be enough Republican senators to override the president, why is Mitch McConnell still being, if I can use this phrase, a wall against bringing anything to the floor of the Senate? I just don't quite get it.
I think I should have been more clear. There are not enough Republican senators now to override the president. There are not remotely. There are only two Republican senators who have publicly signaled that they are ready to reopen government. Only two. But I think if this goes down the road weeks, and months, then you will see that change. But it hasn't changed yet. Right now, they do not have their votes to override the president, and they are very far from getting those votes practically, and certainly not in the House, where they need 50 or more Republicans to join Democrats to override the president. So they're not even close to that.
Okay.
So that's why Mitch McConnell knows that the fastest way to end this shutdown is for the president to agree to something and Democrats.
Okay. So that brings us back to what you said earlier, which was quite bracing. How significant do you think it is that the president did not, or the White House didn't invite the Senate Majority Leader to this press conference last week?
To me, that was a sign that this shutdown could easily last another week or more, because he's not listening to voices like Mitch McConnell, who is someone who can figure out what the paths are to a solution. And instead, he's listening to, I think, the cheerleaders on the right. Now, Kevin McCarthy is not the most conservative member of the House. However, he is someone who doesn't stand up to the president. He's someone who's more of a kind of supporter of the president in general. Mm-hmm. And that's who the president is surrounding himself with right now.
All right. Well, let's go to the callers. Leon is calling from Detroit, Michigan. Leon, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Just kind of a comment about what you guys are just talking about, the extreme positions on each side. And I think that's definitely the issue with anything regarding immigration. It's such a radioactive topic, and people stake out positions on two kind of far axes of the topic, one being the far extreme of, everybody coming into the U.S. is a, law-abiding citizen that's just here looking for a better life, and there's no criminal aspect of, whatsoever. And then obviously the far right extreme that, there's ISIS members and everybody in the groups are MS-13. And the truth is really somewhere in the middle. I was a Border Patrol agent for about 10 years, and I've seen all aspects of it. All aspects of humanity are people trying to enter the country, obviously doing so illegally, but there's groups of people just like anywhere else that you encounter. So the issue for, I think, the politicians as well is that you have a lot of people commenting on this and deciding policy that don't really have the expertise and don't really have that ground truth in what the real issues are on the border.
So, Leon, sorry to jump in here for Leon for a second, but I just want to ask you something. Yeah. I want to reframe what you said a little bit, because, I mean, I see here that you said you're a former Border Patrol agent, and you sort of framed it as like one side is saying all migrants are saints, the other side is saying all migrants are sinners. But I actually think, isn't the debate right now over, I mean, to be blunt about it, that the president and his Republican supporters say the way to fix the problems on the border is a wall. I mean, the issue is the wall right now. And I don't necessarily... What do you think about that?
The wall makes sense. Again, the wall makes sense. There are portions of the border, especially in places like Arizona and California, where the wall has had a tremendous impact. Now, again, people are not understanding what the wall really does and what it means. It's not to just 100% prevent entry in that point. What the wall does is it takes areas of the border that don't have natural boundaries and barriers, like rivers and mountains and terrain that makes it impassable, and it puts that wall barrier there where you can't just drive a vehicle across. Now, that wall creates a barrier in that specific area, which then forces traffic to be funneled to areas where infrastructure and Border Patrol agents and other technology can be in place where apprehension rates can go up. So I think the misconception is that, you know, if we build a Great Wall of China from San Diego to Brownsville, Texas, that will somehow completely eradicate all illegal immigration. I don't think anyone is advocating for that. I don't even think the president is.
He wants 1,000 miles of wall. I mean, right?
In 1,000 miles of wall, you're considering 3,000 miles of southern border. So, again, in places where the wall makes sense, areas like San Diego and San Diego sector in particular, and Tucson sector, which is, you know, Arizona's, they have seen a dramatic decrease. And now where you're seeing the highest entry rates along the southern border are places like South Texas and Rio Grande Valley. And again, there is very limited border wall there because the natural barrier is considered to be the river. But there's places where you can walk across that river because it's ankle deep.
Mm-hmm.
So again, this is what I'm talking about, where people that are commenting on this topic, on both the press and on a lot of the politicians, and, you know, people just don't understand the reality on the ground. They've never been to the areas. They've never actually worked those areas. They don't understand how border enforcement actually works. And for that conversation to have real tangible effects on the American population, I think you need people that are actually in the know being involved in that.
Well, Leon, let me ask you one more question then on that front, just briefly, if I may. What would you do? What do you think the solution is?
I think the solution is, number one, to de-incentivize people from coming into the country. We have a process where American employers and cheap labor is the incentive for people to come here. You also have an issue with interior enforcement that, you know, agencies like ICE are considered to be, again, radioactive and considered to be racist by a lot of people, when in fact they're just performing the laws that the American people through legislation have passed, and those agencies have to enforce it. And I think what needs to happen is a national conversation about what we decide as a country we want to do, but blaming law enforcement for enforcing the laws on the books is not the answer. Yeah. And I think you don't want to live in a society where the police and the border agencies decide which laws they want to enforce and they don't want to enforce.
Well, Leon, I'm going to have to take you back from you there because I'm fast running out of time. But Leon, thank you so very much for your call. Leon there, a former Border Patrol agent who still works for Customs and Border Protection. Really interesting. Lisa Desjardins, hang on here for one more minute, because there's one more voice I want to bring in here again to get back to this issue of federal employees who've been suffering the impact of this shutdown. Heidi Barakowicz joins us now from Washington. She's the lead attorney in a lawsuit filed by the American Federation of Government Employees. The lawsuit alleges that the partial government shutdown is illegally forcing hundreds of thousands of essential employees who are working without pay, or forcing them to work without pay. Heidi Barakowicz, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for your patience here. We just got a couple of minutes before the end of the show here. But first of all, tell us, you filed a similar lawsuit in the last government shutdown. Is that correct?
Yes, in 2013, we filed a lawsuit alleging a violation of the Fair Labor Standards Act on behalf of all of the essential employees who were required to work during the shutdown but didn't get paid on time. And that's exactly what's going on right now. There's 420,000 essential employees who are going to work every day in sometimes incredibly dangerous jobs. And on top of it, now they have to deal with the stress of not knowing how long the shutdown's going to last, when they're going to get their next paycheck, how they're going to put food on the table. I work with a lot of employees who work for the Federal Bureau of Prisons. On Friday, there was an inmate murder in one of the low security institutions. And just from word of mouth, I heard of 8 staff assaults at facilities around the country. So truly, these people have incredibly dangerous jobs, and they don't know when they're getting paid for it.
And so has your lawsuit now, is it a class action lawsuit?
Yes, it's under the Fair Labor Standards Act, it's a collective action, which
okay.
is not exactly like the class action that most people are familiar with. Just under this statute, normally people are familiar with class actions where you're just automatically part of the case, you don't have to do anything. Under the FLSA, all of the individuals have to actually fill out a piece of paper and submit it to the court indicating that they want to be part of the case. They want to recover the back pay, the liquidated damages that they're owed from working during the shutdown and not getting paid on time. We had over 25,000 people opt in 2013 uh-huh. for that case. And it's we're working on setting up an electronic sign-up process, which we'll have online soon through our firm's website, so that all the affected employees yeah. can join this case as well.
Now, just to underscore it, you won that 2013 lawsuit. There is precedent for the court finding in favor of federal workers here in cases where they're not getting paid essential workers for during government shutdowns. I'm also noticing that in just a couple of days, on January 11th, some 420,000 workers could be eligible to join this lawsuit?
Yes. We absolutely won the case in 2013. The court ruled it was a violation of the Fair Labor Standards Act in response to the government's motion yeah. to dismiss. So very early in the litigation, the court confirmed the government was violating the FLSA. The only issue left for us to resolve was whether or not the government was liable for liquidated damages. The court subsequently ruled in our favor on that issue as well, determining that the government failed to act in good faith when it required these essential employees to go to work and didn't pay them on time. Mm. As of right now, a partial paycheck has been issued from the shutdown. Anyone yeah. who worked on December 22nd on overtime did not get paid for it. But we're very soon coming up to the next payday, and
yeah.
it's going to be devastating because there's going to be 800,000 federal employees who are not going to get a paycheck. 420,000 of them are continuing to go to work. They're still having to pay for childcare. I've talked to people who have an hour commute each way to work. They have to pay for gas. They're not getting their transportation subsidies paid right now.
Mm-hmm.
I have clients... employees who I know are working out of state. They're incurring all the expenses for traveling on their detail out of state, and the government's not going to be paying off their government yeah. credit cards, which are in their name. They're having to front those expenses. Truly devastating.
Right. Well, Heidi Barakowitz, a lead attorney in a lawsuit filed by the American Federation of Government Employees, alleging that the partial shutdown is illegally forcing hundreds of thousands of employees to work without pay. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, Lisa, because I'm also seeing here that Politico has been reporting that on January 11th, the judiciary system will run out of money and start sending workers home. So another way in which the shutdown, the impact of the shutdown is spreading. We got about a minute left to go, Lisa. We've talked a lot about Senate Republicans, about the president. Tell me a little bit more about what Democrats are thinking now and where you see their next steps going, if any.
I think for the past week and a half, Democrats have felt that the president mishandled this, and they felt that they, if anything, have kind of walked farther away from the compromise they were offering. People who've been paying close attention might notice that at one point they offered $1.6 billion, then $1.3 billion for a wall. Now Nancy Pelosi is only in just offering a dollar. So I think for the moment, Democrats feel like it's in their favor to let the president seem to be scrambling. And that means the shutdown could continue.
Well, Lisa Desjardins, correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. She covers Congress. We have links to her excellent reporting at onpointradio.org. Lisa, it's always a pleasure to have you. Thank you so very much.
What a great show. Thank you for asking me.
Listeners, by the way, we want to hear more of your stories about how this shutdown is affecting your day-to-day life, your job, maybe the benefits that you rely on. We heard from farmers and small business people worried about loans. So post on our social media channels, Facebook and Twitter at On Point Radio, and let us know how this shutdown is having an impact on you. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.